From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, treating extreme frostbite, snow blindness, and altitude sickness. We talk with Dr. Kenneth Kamler, who has made several climbs on Mount Everest as an expedition doctor. He's worked with National Geographic and NASA. He was on Everest during the disastrous storm of 1996 and treated the survivors. He's written a new memoir called Doctor on Everest, Emergency Medicine at the Top of the World. And Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new recording of Handel's opera Alcina featuring Renee Fleming. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Lawyers for Vice President Al Gore presented their appeal before Florida's Supreme Court today, asking the justices to order a recount of thousands of disputed ballots. Lawyers for Governor George W. Bush contend that Gore failed to prove his case in trial court and say the appeal should be dismissed. NPR's Melissa Block reports from Tallahassee.
From the outset, the justices appeared skeptical that they should even be ruling on this matter. They asked pointed questions as to why they should take up this case, if it is properly within their jurisdiction. The Gore team argues that thousands of untallied ballots were never examined by the trial court judge before he ruled, rejecting a recount. Gore lawyers say there is still enough time to complete that recount before next Tuesday, the deadline for states to pick their electors. They say the result of that count could place in doubt the result of the election. The vice president's campaign chair, William Daley, was in the courtroom for the arguments. So too was Florida's Republican Senate president, John McKay, who was convening a special session of the legislature on Friday to pick its own slate of electors. Melissa Block, NPR News, Tallahassee.
Palestinian attackers wounded five Israelis today as the violence continued in the West Bank and Gaza. Three Israelis were hurt when gunmen ambushed their car near a Jewish settlement in the West Bank. In Gaza, a Palestinian laborer stabbed and wounded two Israelis before he was shot to death by Israeli guards. Nearly 300 people, most of them Palestinians, have been killed in the violence. The United Nations says that more than 9,000 Palestinians have been injured. A group of Israeli peace activists met today with Palestinian Authority President Yasser Arafat, urging him to rejoin peace talks. Edmund Pope, the American convicted yesterday on spy charges in Russia, has asked Russian President Vladimir Putin for a pardon. His chances reportedly look good. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports.
The head of the Presidential Pardons Commission, which will decide Pope's fate, said he believes the commission will be humane. Anatoly Pristovkin predicted his commission will recommend that Putin pardon Edmund Pope so that the American businessman can go home to be with his family. Pope's wife Sherry says she hopes she'll be able to take him home soon. Pope was sentenced to 20 years in jail for stealing Russian defense secrets. He has maintained his innocence, saying he was researching non-classified technology. His lawyer said Pope had lost faith in the Russian justice system. Rather than appealing to the Supreme Court, he, along with the Clinton administration, appealed to Putin directly. Pope argued he's in poor health and needs medical care. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Moscow.
Stock prices closed lower today on Wall Street after Motorola announced that fourth quarter sales and earnings would fall short of forecasts. The Dow Jones Industrials lost 46 points to close at 10,618. The Nasdaq lost 44 points, or 1.5%. It closed at 2752. This is NPR News. Two astronauts from the space shuttle Endeavour have completed their third and final spacewalk on the International Space Station. Joe Tanner and Carlos Noriega restored the tension to a loose wing of solar panels. A federal judge in Chicago lifted an injunction designed to prevent mechanics from United Airlines from carrying out an organized work slowdown. NPR's Cheryl Corley reports.
The Chicago ruling to lift the injunction came as the airline and machinists resumed contract talks in Washington, D.C. for the first time in a month. United had charged the union was illegally causing delays and cancellations by taking planes out of service for repairs when none were needed. The machinists say there is no work slowdown, and the union has done all it could to prevent one. However, as he lifted the temporary restraining order, federal judge William Hibbler called it somewhat ineffective in encouraging the mechanics to do their jobs without trying to influence the negotiations. Both Both sides are due back in court Wednesday. United wants a permanent injunction. If there's a spike in the number of planes taken out of service for repairs by Wednesday, the judge says it would serve as a gauge of what further action the court needed to take. Cheryl Corley, NPR News, Chicago.
Federal safety officials say nearly 100,000 scooters are being recalled because of dangerous handlebars. The Consumer Product Safety Commission says the brand called Kent Kickin' Mini Scooters is recalling about 90,000 units because the handlebars can come out of the steering column. Another brand called Racer X20 from Cash and Gold Limited is recalling 7,500 scooters because a joint between the handlebars can break. The problems are blamed for 6 injuries, and the commission is urging owners of those brands to stop riding them. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, makers of all-natural vitamin E, ADM, supermarket to the world, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. During the disastrous snowstorm on Mount Everest in 1996, my guest, Dr. Kenneth Kamler, was on the mountain taking care of survivors. That was one of several climbs he's made as an expedition doctor on Everest. He's treated extreme frostbite, snow blindness, and altitude sickness, and has risked his life to save others. He's conducted research on Everest in conjunction with National Geographic and NASA. Dr. Kamler is also a hand surgeon. He directs the Hand Treatment Center in New Hyde Park, New York. He's written a new memoir called Doctor on Everest, Emergency Medicine at the Top of the World. I asked him how good a climber you have to be in order to work as an expedition doctor.
Well, of course, that depends on what mountain you're climbing.
Good point.
Yeah, on a mountain like Everest, you have to be, a very accomplished climber to even get started on the mountain. It's a very technically difficult mountain, and many of the difficulties come right at the beginning. So if you want to be an effective doctor, you have to be up where the problems are, which are high up for the most part. And you can't even get there if you're not able to get past the first barriers, which come lower down.
And the problems are high up because that's where the oxygen thins and where the air pressure changes.
Yeah, if you think about it, the summit of Everest is 29,035 feet. That's about the same height as the cruising altitude for a transatlantic jet. So there's only about a third as much oxygen as there is at sea level. And your body can't burn fuel efficiently at that height. So your metabolism is sort of like smoldering instead of burning. And you can't give yourself enough energy, so it's easy to get into trouble at that altitude.
What are some of the medicines you pack with you when you're working as an expedition doctor?
That's a difficult problem. It's like Everest itself, the challenge of packing medicine is daunting if you don't take it one step at a time. So I try and think of every injury I might encounter and every problem I might run into. Then I list every supply I would need for it, from cardiac stimulants to adhesive tape, because if I don't bring it, I don't have it, and I have no chance of getting it. But even more subtly, I have to consider the quantities which I have to bring, because in climbing, weight is critical, and I have to limit my supplies, recognizing that I might run short in a major disaster. And as you go up the mountain, you can take less and less. I started base camp with about 4 yak loads of supplies, but by camp 2, which is 4,000 feet higher, I'm reduced to just a fishing tackle box worth of equipment. And then higher than that, I just take what I can put in a plastic bag and keep inside my pocket. Medications freeze. If I don't carry them right against my chest, they'll be frozen and, for the most part, unusable.
What are some of the main differences in how the body works high on a mountain compared to how the body works at ground level?
Yeah, the biggest problem is with the lack of air. There's only one-third the air pressure as there is at sea level. And since metabolism depends on burning oxygen, you don't have that ability. And it's, as I was saying before, it's like a smoldering fire. So your metabolism is very low. Plus, at that altitude, temperatures can run 40 degrees below zero or even colder, and you can have winds that can be up to 40 miles an hour or more. You're so high up that you're actually exposed to the jet stream. So you're dealing with wind chill factors that you'd only find on the surface of Mars, maybe. And added to that, you're at the summit after several days of relentless climbing. You've probably had very little to eat or drink. You've had maybe half a bowl of warm water on summit day when you start out. And you'll be out for 16 or 20 hours that day. It's a very, very long day. And you'll be burning 12 to 15,000 calories, which is about 10 times your normal amount. So you're really on the edge of survival there. And to give you an idea of just how thin the margin of survival is, I remember on one of my own summit attempts, I was carrying a water bottle inside my down jacket against my chest. And as I was coming back from the attempt, I wanted to take a drink of water, and I reached inside my jacket, and my water bottle was frozen. So you really see how thin your margin of survival is there.
Gee, remind me to climb a mountain on my next vacation.
I wonder myself what I'm doing there sometimes.
What's breathing like that high up?
Well, as you get higher, it gets harder to breathe. At that height, it's essentially taking one step and then several breaths and then one more step and then several breaths. It becomes extremely laborious to breathe. Breathing requires muscle power. And you get to the point where the muscle power required to breathe uses up more oxygen than what you're taking in. So it becomes a law of diminishing returns. In fact, the summit of Everest is physiologically just about man's limit as to where they can breathe.
Because the body is under such stress at these high altitudes, it must be very difficult for you as a doctor to figure out what's, say, a normal headache caused by the high altitude, and when is that headache a symptom of a very serious life-threatening problem.
Yeah, that is a very difficult problem because everybody gets headaches for various reasons. It could be something you ate or didn't eat, and it could be due to just tension, nerves, exhaustion. There's all kinds of reasons to have a headache, and virtually everybody does get a headache. But that same headache can be a forerunner of very serious conditions such as pulmonary edema or cerebral edema. And it's only with a lot of experience, I think, that you can really get a good feel for who has a critical condition and who doesn't. I can't send everybody back down the mountain who has a headache, or no one would ever climb. So it's a lot of it is just sort of just by feel and by experience.
Yeah, you write about a situation on, I think it was your first climb as an expedition doctor, where someone had a headache, you gave them a couple of aspirin. There seemed to be more serious problems to treat at the moment, but it turned out this person did have pulmonary edema. How could you tell that it had progressed to something very serious?
Yeah, I think in that case it was probably my own inexperience. It was my first expedition. I was dealing with a lot of climbers who did have headaches, and one of our Sherpas complained just sort of along with the others that he also had a headache. And at the time, I took it to just I had the idea that he just sort of wanted to feel like part of the group. And almost said he had a headache just because he wanted to belong, in a sense. And I didn't take him as seriously as I should have. I did give him some aspirin, and he seemed thankful for that, but I didn't really examine him. And had I examined him, I might have seen some clinical signs, which would have tipped me off. But I just gave him some aspirin, and that next morning I was awakened by other Sherpas because they could not awaken him. And he, in fact, had gone into pulmonary edema and even some cerebral edema.
What is that, and how did you treat it?
Yeah, that's a condition where fluid in the body comes outside its normal area where it's held, and it comes out of the blood. It starts to swell in other tissues. A good way to visualize it is that the air pressure that we normally live under holds fluid in our lungs, and as the air pressure decreases, that fluid is no longer held back, and it's like breaking a dike. The fluid leaks out. It gets into the system where in the lungs it can essentially cause drowning. You're developing fluid in areas that shouldn't have anything but air in them. And in a similar way, the fluid leaks out of the brain. And since the brain is enclosed in a hard skull, there's no room for extra fluid. So that fluid causes pressure buildup, which can lead to unconsciousness and can lead to death. So this Sherpa had developed that condition. And had I examined him, maybe I would have picked it up earlier. But sometimes you can't tell even on the most careful examination.
What were you able to do for him once you did diagnose it?
Well, then what we had to do was I tried to give him fluids. We had to start an intravenous line, which is even that's not as easy as you might think. Since everything is frozen at that altitude, we had to thaw out the IV bags of fluid and start giving him some fluid, which would reduce the pressure in his brain. You give him steroid-type medications, which will sort of act like wringing out a sponge and decrease his pressure. It's a temporary measure, but it can be life-saving until he can be evacuated.
And what was the outcome?
The outcome was good. We were lucky in a sense. We were able to stabilize him long enough to get him evacuated. The weather conditions were terrible, and we couldn't get a helicopter in because of the weather. But we were able to load him up on a stretcher and carry him out. And he actually did quite well, to the point where the expedition lasted about 2 months. And toward the end of the expedition, he actually came back and rejoined us.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Kenneth Kamler. He's a hand surgeon, but he's also a mountain climbing expedition doctor, and his new memoir is called Doctor on Everest. He was there, by the way, during the storm in 1996. What's the impact on your ability to think clearly and to remember things when you have so little oxygen getting to your brain because the air is so thin? Does it make it difficult for you to function well as a doctor?
Yes, it does. I'm called upon to make some critical medical decisions, which are complicated enough in a modern hospital intensive care unit. And I'm often in a situation where I'm not getting enough oxygen myself, and it's very cold, and the cold is sort of debilitating as well. So you often have a situation where it's hard to think clearly, and sometimes it's literally confusing to figure out how to tie your shoes. That becomes a problem, much less making difficult medical decisions. But I find that I'm aware that I'm thinking slowly. It's not like I'm hallucinating. I'm very aware of the situation. I'm aware I'm thinking slowly, and therefore I can just sort of concentrate and focus, and I find I can get the job done, even though it's a little harder than would be at sea level.
So what happens if you need a doctor?
Yeah, that's what people often say to me up on the mountain. The people I climb with are very experienced, and they very often do climb without doctors on other expeditions. So many of them do have a good deal of medical experience. Some of them are emergency medical technicians, and they've had a lot of firsthand experience. So I think that they would be able to take care of me in an emergency situation.
My guest is Dr. Kenneth Kamler, author of Doctor on Everest. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dr. Kenneth Kamler. His new book, Doctor on Everest, is about his work as an expedition doctor. You were an expedition doctor in 1996 during the storm on Everest, in which so much has been written and filmed about. Where were you during the storm?
Yeah, when that storm hit, I was at 24,000 feet, which is what we call Camp 3. And the climbers who got in trouble were 2,000 feet above me at Camp 4. They had just gone for the summit that day, and we were in our camp below them listening on the radio as to what had happened to them. And we had heard that they had summited just in the afternoon, but even though there was some celebration on their part, it made us all very nervous because they had summited very late in the afternoon. It's a good rule to make sure you have enough daylight to get back with plenty to spare. And they had summited at about 2:30 in the afternoon, which was a very late time to be coming down. They only had a few hours of daylight left and no margin for error. And at that point, we were just sort of hoping they'd get back down. But a storm came up, and unexpectedly, the mountain was just engulfed by the worst, most intense storm I've ever seen. And we knew that they were still out high above their camp, which would have been their shelter. So we were quite nervous about them, and it got dark, and we still had no word that they were back, and in fact, they did not get back. They were stuck out in that storm, and they were unable to get back to their tents. So I was at Camp 3 at that point, which was a place where I would be unable to even treat anybody. We were 2,000 feet below them. They were almost inaccessible to us, but our strongest climbers risked their lives to go up and try and rescue them, and two of our climbers did make it up to the area where most of the climbers were, and started doing what they could for first aid. Where I was, I could radio advice, but we realized we'd have to get the survivors back down if I was going to treat them at all. There was no way that I could get up to that height, and there would be nothing I could do for them at that height anyway. So,
what did you do to prepare in the hopes that climbers would come down, knowing that if they did come down, they would need help?
Well, I was in a place where I was on a 45-degree icy slope. It's just a notch cut into the mountain. The camp is really, it's just enough room for a tent, and you can't even stand up without roping yourself in. It's bitter cold. Everything freezes. I had very little equipment with me. I just had that plastic bag worth of supplies. My supplies were 2,000 feet lower down. So we felt that if we could get the survivors down to the next lower camp, Camp 2, we'd have a much better chance of treating them and keeping them alive. So we worked out a plan where the climbers would have to stay overnight at Camp 4, which was already a dangerous place to stay, but there was just no way we could bring them down that late in the day. So we waited overnight. The climbers did survive overnight, and as they were being brought down by the rescuers, I myself down climbed 2,000 feet to that lower camp. So what I did was I took the New Zealand camp's mess tent, which was the largest tent in the area, and turned that essentially into a little field hospital. I laid out foam mats on the ice and sleeping bags on top of those. We collected sets of dry clothes because I anticipated that the climbers would be soaked and they would have to get out of their freezing clothes. I hooked up IV bags from the tent, which had to be defrosted first in warm water. And we had oxygen tanks. I opened them up, got them ready, put out my bandages, my medications. And I had the Sherpas boil up as much water as we could because I anticipated some severe frostbite. I knew I'd have to warm their body parts.
How many people made it down who you ended up treating?
There were two critical climbers who came down. Beck Weathers, the American climber who got a lot of publicity in the United States, and a Taiwanese climber named Makalu Gao, who was in very similar condition as Beck. They both had severe frostbite and hypothermia.
Well, how did you treat Beck Weathers? Many Americans saw the photos of his extreme frostbite when he came down from the mountaintop. He wasn't expected to live. Go ahead.
Yeah, he was not expected to live. In fact, when we first heard about Beck, we heard that he was dead. That was our first report. He had been found in the snow at Camp 4 and pronounced dead. And our rescuers were tending to the other ones who were still alive when Beck suddenly just appeared out of a swirling fog, and he just staggered into base camp. And I remember getting the radio report from one of the rescuers. He said, "Beck is alive, but I don't know for how long." We really weren't sure he'd even survive the night, but he did survive the night, and he was brought back down to us. When I caught up with him at Camp 2, I expected an incoherent, a half-conscious phantom, but he walked into the tent, and he said, "Hi, Ken, where should I sit?" He was really very well-oriented, much better than I expected. So we laid him down on the mat and on the sleeping bag, and we started an IV, and I started to examine him, and he had the worst frostbite I've ever seen, and I've seen quite a bit of frostbite. His right hand and wrist were purple and frozen, and all the way to a third of the way up his forearm. His left hand was also frozen. His nose was just a brittle black crust. It looked as if he would sneeze, he would just blow it away. So the first thing to do was to make sure that he wouldn't die of hypothermia. So we started that intravenous line, but that in itself is a problem because the fluids are so cold at that altitude. They have to first be defrosted, and then you have to make sure they're warm because the last thing you want to do is put cold fluid into someone who's already cold. So we used hand warmers, the kind of chemical hand warmers that skiers might use, and wrapped them around the IV bags to try to keep them warm. Once I was sure Beck was warm enough, we started the process of trying to thaw out his hands and feet. So we had buckets of warm water, and I put his hands and feet in there. It was very difficult to keep the water warm because of the outside temperature being below zero and because of the fact that his hands and feet were essentially blocks of ice, and they would cool the water very rapidly. So we had to keep reheating the water and adding it and measuring the temperature. It was a difficult, very time-consuming job, but the Sherpas, most of whom had never used a thermometer before in their lives, very quickly got the hang of how to do it and sort of took over monitoring the temperature while I could look into their medical condition a little more.
Are there any dangers when you're defrosting somebody's body parts that have frostbite? Are there any dangers in having the temperature being too warm or in trying to defrost them too rapidly?
Yeah, that's a very interesting point that people don't realize very often. I'm dealing with a frozen body part, and when I try to rewarm that, if I do it too quickly, of course, they might burn. They might get burns, and since their hands are not able to feel pain, they wouldn't even be able to tell me. So you have to be very careful about the temperature. And of course, if it's too low, you're not going to be effective. But an even more difficult problem is that if their bodies are not warm, their hearts will be a little bit cool, and cooled heart muscle is very sensitive, and it can react by going into what we call an arrhythmia, a pattern of beating which would not allow blood to flow and can be fatal. So I had to be careful that their body temperature was high enough where their heart was functioning properly, because if I suddenly rewarmed their hands, that wave of cold, of cold blood which would come out of their hands into their body could be a shock which could kill them.
So how did he survive your treatment?
Well, he did amazingly well. He did survive, as did Makalu. They lived through the night. I stayed up all night taking care of them, just making sure their IVs were working, making sure they were breathing. It was freezing cold. We had one propane heater, which we kept aimed on my two patients. To keep myself warm, I tried to do as much as I could without getting out of my sleeping bag. And we did manage to get through the night. In the morning, we were hoping that a helicopter would be able to come to evacuate the two climbers. But the wind was still blowing so hard that there was just no way the helicopter pilot said he could land. So at that point, I had to make a decision as to whether or not I should try to keep them at 21,000 feet in a second day, or whether we should try to evacuate them over the ice. Over the ice evacuation is quite dangerous. You have to go through a lot of crevasses. It's technically difficult. And it would not be me who would be risking his life to evacuate these people, since we would be using our strongest climbers. So I would be asking our strongest climbers to risk their lives to bring down these two sick climbers. But the alternative was to leave them another day at 21,000 feet, and I didn't feel they could survive another day at that altitude. That 21,000 feet is an altitude where cuts won't even heal. And I had two climbers who were so critically ill that I've seen healthier-looking patients die in an intensive care unit.
Why won't cuts heal at that altitude?
There's just not enough oxygen. The body is functioning at its bare limit. The body does what it has to do to keep itself alive, but it has no extra energy, so to speak, to bring about healing. It's the last place you want to have a critical person.
So what did you decide to do?
Well, I knew my decision would be taken without question. So it was a difficult decision, but I felt that we had to get these two climbers out. And I felt we should evacuate them over the ice, even knowing that we'd be risking other climbers. So we prepared to do that. The climbers organized themselves into rescue teams. I packed up the two climbers as best I could, keeping them as warm as I possibly could. And we started out with that in mind, going down the ice fall. We were at 21,000 feet, and we had a stretch to go of 2,000 feet, after which we would enter the ice fall, which is the most dangerous area filled with crevasses. And as we were going down the route, I was trailing behind the rescuers, and I remember thinking how I'm going to manage these climbers when I get them down to base camp, and you know what other problems I might encounter as we went through the ice fall. I didn't realize as we were going that the wind had died down. And all of a sudden, I was startled to hear a noise and then look up and see a helicopter. So the pilot had been monitoring the weather conditions. He noticed the lull in the wind immediately and made a very daring rescue. He came in that lull in the wind and landed in a crevasse field and was able to lift out the two climbers, one by one, actually. And he was flying his helicopter above the limit that was considered safe for that helicopter. He was at 19,000 feet. The limit of the helicopter was 17,000 feet. But he risked his life to go higher and bring these climbers out. And, in fact, he did get them both out. He helicoptered them out to Kathmandu, where they were in a hospital before we even got back to base camp.
Dr. Kenneth Kamler, his new memoir is called Doctor on Everest. He's also a hand surgeon and directs the Hand Treatment Center in New Hyde Park, New York. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873, online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN, and from Random House Incorporated Bantam Books Division, publisher of Flags of Our Fathers by James Bradley with Ron Powers, the story of the men who raised the flag on Iwo Jima. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, snow blindness. We continue our conversation with Dr. Kenneth Kamler, a surgeon who served as an expedition doctor on Mount Everest. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new recording of Handel's opera Alcina, starring Renee Fleming. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Dr. Kenneth Kamler. He's a hand specialist who also works as an expedition doctor for teams climbing Mount Everest. He's written a new memoir called Doctor on Everest, Emergency Medicine at the Top of the World. When we left off, we were talking about the disastrous storm on Everest in 1996. Dr. Kamler was on the mountain treating survivors. During the storm, did you have to treat a lot of snow blindness?
Yeah, there were several cases of snow blindness. Snow blindness is a condition where the cornea, which is the window of the eye, becomes burned. It's like a sunburn of that covering, and it results in total blindness, and it's extremely painful. What's good about it is that it's generally self-limiting. In a few days, it clears up. But for the few days that you have it, it's quite painful, and you're totally blind. So if you're in a hospital, you can sort of get by with pain medicine and rest. But if you're high up on a mountain in freezing conditions, you can see very easily how that blindness could be fatal to you. So I did treat some patients, some climbers with that condition who managed to get down with the help of others. And then it cleared up on its own.
What were you able to do to help them through that period?
Well, I brought along a lot of pain medicine. And what we could do is just patch their eyes closed and keep them in a safe place and actually guide them down blind, which is something that some of the rescuers would do.
And what burns the eye? Is it the cold or is it the snow hitting the eye?
Yeah, well, the most common problem is that when you're high up on Everest, you need oxygen. And the oxygen is somewhat warm. And if you're wearing a face mask, it causes fogging. So your face mask very quickly gets fogged out. And there's a very strong tendency for climbers to lift off their face mask at that point because they can't see. They're on treacherous slopes, and quite obviously you have to watch where you're putting your feet. So there's a huge temptation to improve your vision by taking your goggles off. And once you do that, your eyes are exposed to the brilliant sunlight at that altitude. There's very little filtering of radiation from the sun at that altitude. Plus, the rays of the sun bounce off the ice. So you get an intensification of the rays of the sun, and it can very quickly burn your eyes. And since there are no pain sensors in the cornea itself, you don't realize you're burning your eyes until later on when it really gets very severe. So climbers will often take their goggles off for the immediate problem of seeing where to put their feet, but then they pay for it later because they burn the corneas.
So in what conditions are Beck Weathers and McAloo now, the two people with the extreme frostbite who you treated?
Well, Beck I'm still very much in contact with. He's a pathologist. Lucky for him, it's about the only field of medicine you can practice without hands. Beck, in fact, unfortunately, did lose both his hands. He has a prosthetic hand on one side, and he has a kind of a pinching mechanism on the other side. But he is able to function. He's gone back to work as a pathologist. And just like he didn't let the mountain stop him, he didn't let his disability stop him either. As for McAloo, he went to Alaska for treatment. He was in hospitals almost a year, but as he told me, he knew it was time to get back to Taiwan because the doctors in Alaska wanted to refashion a nose for him, and he said he didn't want to have a Caucasian nose. So he headed back to Taiwan, where I haven't heard from him since.
How did the deaths during the storm on Everest and the extreme injuries affect your attitude about climbing again?
Well, when you've climbed all over the world and had a lot of experiences, you always are involved with people who are dying on the mountain. It's not that unusual to have climbers die on the mountain. So it's something that we've all thought about, and we wouldn't be climbers if we didn't sort of accept that risk and understand that that can happen. But having said that, I have to say this was the first time that my friends died on the mountain, and that puts it in a whole other perspective. The risk is no longer abstract. It becomes real. And having a consolation like saying something like they die doing what they love, it suddenly seemed ridiculous. Nobody loves freezing to death. And saying things like we go for the thrill of the climb, it sounds pretty thin compared to the devastation you see in the families of the people who died up there. But the risk is inherent in climbing, and it's actually, I think it's essential for the sport. It's part of the appeal. It's not an appeal as a daredevil might enjoy it. Because in climbing, you assume a risk that makes you responsible for your actions, and your actions have direct, immediate consequences. It's a kind of a refreshing condition that's often lacking in modern lives where the actions and the effects of what you do are dissipated. So the risk is essential to the sport. It's actually, I think, what elevates climbing above a sport. And someone like me who goes climbing has to just believe you can control a lot of the risk, keep it within an acceptable limit, although honestly, I'm not sure that taking any risk is acceptable.
How did your family feel about you climbing again?
Well, my wife is actually very supportive. She'd certainly prefer that I had another hobby, but she understands that it's important to me, and even though she doesn't join me physically on the climbs, she certainly is with me in spirit, to the point where she relates my climbing stories with so much detail and animation that listeners just assume she was there with me. And in turn, I never forget the investment my family has in me, and I try to climb as cautiously as I possibly can. One time I was on Everest, I was only 900 feet below the summit, but I turned back because I felt conditions at that point were too dangerous. That's 900 feet on a 29,000-foot mountain. Had I continued on and made the summit, it would have only probably taken another hour, and this was after a two-month expedition, but I felt conditions were dangerous, and I turned around. When I told my wife that story, I thought she'd be disappointed, but actually she was prouder of me than if I had summited, because she felt that I understood what was most important, and what I had waiting for me at home was far more important than the top of the mountain.
Did you ever make it to the top?
No, I haven't. I've been on Everest six times. That particular time that I just told you about was my third attempt, and essentially I have had no attempts since then, because my fourth chance was the time that the disaster occurred, and of course at that point we abandoned any idea of summiting and just took care of the injured people. And then I've been back two more times since then, but both those times I went with expeditions sponsored by NASA, and those were research expeditions where we tested medical equipment to try to develop equipment which could prevent or at least lessen the risk of the kind of disaster that happened in 96.
My guest is Dr. Kenneth Kamler, author of Doctor on Everest. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Kenneth Kamler. He's a hand surgeon, a hand specialist, but he's also a mountain climbing expedition doctor, and his new memoir is called Doctor on Everest. And one of his expeditions was in 1996 during that storm on Everest. You've never made it to the top, and as a doctor, you've often had to tell people on expeditions that they couldn't continue the climb for health reasons, that they just weren't healthy enough to go any further. What's the range of reaction you've gotten to telling people, you know, it's over for you, you got to go back down instead of going up?
It's always a difficult thing to tell somebody that, because a lot of people put a lot of their dreams, a lot of their time, a lot of their money into climbing Everest. I think it's a little easier for me to understand what's involved in that, because it happened to me. My first climb, I also had ideas that I would be able to summit. I felt I was in good condition before I went, and I thought that I had a real good shot to make it also. And when I first realized, as I relate in the book, that I wasn't going to make it, I was surprised at how much it affected me. I had already felt like I was a successful doctor. I had a kind of storybook family that gave me a lot of satisfaction. I didn't think that Everest would be such an important goal for me, but when I found out that I wasn't going to make it on that trip, it really hit me hard, and I was surprised at how much I had wrapped up in Everest. So I really understood how it would affect other people, and I try to let them down as gently as I can. Everyone understands it's a dangerous mountain, and no one questions my decisions on the mountain, which makes me even more careful in telling somebody they can't climb. But we always have to remember what's the most important. It's in fact only a mountain. So I think if I let people down gently, what I try to do is explain their medical situation to them and let them realize that for their own good, they better not climb. And I try to sort of evolve their thinking in a way that they tell me they better not go on.
Your last couple of expeditions on Everest, you served as a chief high-altitude physician on research projects, sponsored in part by NASA. What were you testing?
After the 96 disaster, the people at NASA understood that the climbers near the summit of Everest were as out of reach for us as if they'd been on the moon. And the analogy struck them that this might be a way that they could test their own equipment. NASA had been developing remote sensing devices to use for astronauts on the moon or in a space station because there are a lot of similarities. They're going to have people out there who will not be able to get medical care, at least not directly. So they developed these devices, which could be worn on the body, which would monitor blood pressure, pulse, respiration, body temperature. We developed pills that people could swallow, which would give their internal body temperature by broadcasting a signal. All this high space-age technology. But what they wanted to do was see if it worked outside the lab. So they thought they could bring this to Everest, put it on climbers, and we would monitor how they did. And literally, I got a call from out of the blue because they were looking for a doctor to go along with them to first to take care of their engineers and scientists, and secondly, to actually monitor this equipment and see if the readings made sense. So we've done two expeditions like that. And in fact, the equipment has been developed and it's been working pretty well.
What does it accomplish for the climbers and for you as their doctor?
Yeah, well, this is groundbreaking stuff because we can now send people out into dangerous situations such as mountain climbing or wilderness situations, a backpacker or a hiker or a firefighter in the woods. Anyone can wear this equipment. It's very lightweight. It only weighs a few pounds. And this can be monitored at a base station. So we can hook this up to a global positioning satellite, which the person can also wear. So at any time, we can know where a person is and what kind of condition he's in. So if he needs rescuing, we can know that by just measuring his vital signs, knowing if he's alive or not, and knowing within a couple of yards of where he is. If we had had this equipment on Everest, we perhaps could have saved some of the people who were still lying up there on the mountain. And certainly it's not limited to mountain climbers. We could save people lost in the woods, and we could send out rescuers if we knew the people were alive and not risk rescuers if we knew that the people were not savable.
Would you like to go to the moon and test it out there?
Well, I've done a lot of expeditions. I've been around the world. It certainly would be tempting to go to the moon and test it out, but I also miss my family, and I'm not sure I'd want to take such a long trip again.
You know, one of the problems that keeps creeping up in your book is the problem of sanitation, both in doing your work as a physician and making sure that the conditions you're working in are clean and that the equipment you're using is clean, but your own personal hygiene as well is difficult to keep up in the kind of conditions you live in. Can you talk a little bit about that kind of problem as a doctor with personal hygiene and the conditions around you?
Yeah, the hygiene is difficult. You don't get to wash very often, particularly above base camp. We are able to set up a shower system at base camp, which is a real luxury on a mountain climbing expedition. So at base camp, we can wash up. People always ask about going to the bathroom. That's something you can do even though it's cold out. We do build ice walls to block the wind, and then really no matter how cold it is, you still manage to go to the bathroom without too much trouble. But as you get higher, it gets more difficult. What people don't understand about climbing very often is that you don't just relentlessly move up the mountain. You move up to a higher camp, you set it up, and then you go down to base camp. And then you build a higher camp in a leapfrog sort of way so that you're constantly returning back down to base camp every few days. So at base camp, we can sort of take care of personal hygiene a little better. Going higher up on the mountain, there really isn't much you can do.
Excuse me if this is a silly question, but you talked about bathroom facilities. Urine must be among the warmer things in the area. Is there any way to channel that heat that you temporarily get from it?
Not that we've ever done in any kind of practical way. You do lose a lot of heat when you urinate. There really isn't much you could do about it. I suppose you could if you wanted to. We all carry what we call pee bottles in the tent so that you don't have to get out of the tent when you feel the need to urinate. And that is warm, and you could put that in your sleeping bag. In fact, we do put it in our sleeping bags so that heat that is within the urine can be sort of recycled, so to speak, within your sleeping bag. But even doing that, often we find overnight that the urine will freeze inside the bag. But it does give you that second chance to use the heat.
Now, in the rest of your life, you're a hand surgeon.
Yes.
You write a little bit about that in your book, Doctor on Everest, and you say the hand is the part of the body that we feel closest to after our face. What's so personal about the hand, do you think?
People do so much with their hands. Their hand is in front of them all day. They really can't function without a hand. It's a body part they're very aware of all the time. So other than the face, I think that's a part you identify with. People realize that if they lost their hands, they would lose a great part of their lifestyle. So people attach a lot of importance to it, obviously.
You must see the results of some pretty bizarre accidents.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you do. I treat a lot of athletes who have injuries, a lot of people who work in factories where machines injure their hands. And I also take care of a lot of people with rheumatoid arthritis or a lot of kids who are born with malformed hands. We try to correct them and turn them into useful tools.
As a hand surgeon who needs your hands to perform the surgery, don't you worry about taking care of your hands when you're on an expedition?
Yeah, I do. In fact, believe it or not, I take 18 pairs of gloves with me when I go climbing for all kinds of conditions. I often wear 3 pairs of gloves at a time, as do other climbers. We're very aware of the problems with the hands, but in fact, my hands are less at risk climbing ice, which is what I usually do, as compared to if I was climbing rock. Because when you climb rock, you actually have to put your hands in positions where they get twisted and can get broken. When you climb ice, you climb with ice tools, with axes and hammers. So all you have to do is grip those, so your hands are not stressed nearly as much. The real risk is frostbite, and you know, we do as much as we can to avoid that, but my hands have come through pretty well.
Did you ever have frostbite?
I've had frostbite once in my face, but interestingly enough, that was not on Everest or any other major mountain in the world. That happened in New Hampshire, where conditions can often be very, very cold. I was near the summit of Mount Washington in a windstorm, and I got frostbite on my face, and that was the only time I've had it.
Huh. So what's next for you in your work as an expedition doctor?
Well, it's hard to say. I sort of take it as it comes. I still haven't summited Everest, and that would be nice to do, but that's just one goal among many. You know, I've spent a lot of time on Everest, and I think the idea of developing this equipment with NASA is very rewarding, and perhaps even more rewarding than summiting. So I still have an interest in doing that. But as I was saying before, it takes a lot of time. It's something I have to balance with my family life and with my professional life.
Do you worry as a doctor about taking risks that could jeopardize your ability to continue helping your patients?
Yeah, I do worry about that some. But I also don't want to feel like I'm a prisoner of my profession. My wife and I have spoken about this many times. And if I were to just not go at all, I would really feel like I lost out on something in life. So I'd rather try to balance the two and do what I can. I'm still a doctor. Even if I lose the ability to do fine surgery, I could still do other work, and I think I could still be constructive and have a functional, positive career, even if somehow I did lose the ability to operate.
Well, Dr. Kamler, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Dr. Kenneth Kamler is the author of the new memoir, Doctor on Everest. He also directs the Hand Treatment Center in New Hyde Park, New York. Coming up, Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new recording of Handel's opera Alcina, starring Renee Fleming. This is Fresh Air. Last year, the Chicago Lyric Opera imported a Parisian production of Handel's opera about passion and magic, Alcina. Our classical music critic, Lloyd Schwartz, thought it was one of the best opera productions he'd ever seen. A live recording of the original Paris performance, with most of the stellar cast Lloyd heard in Chicago, has now been released by Erato. Here's Lloyd's review.
In opera, so many factors have to go absolutely right. Singing, conducting, stage direction, scenery. It's almost by definition doomed to failure. So when an inspired production comes along, you have to be especially grateful. That was the case with Canadian director Robert Carson's version of Handel's Alcina that I was lucky to catch in Chicago last year. Alcina is a sorceress, a latter-day Circe, who enchants men and transforms them into animals. The twist in Handel's opera is that Alcina falls in love with one of her victims, the knight Ruggiero. But Ruggiero has a fiancé, Bradamante, who doesn't give up. She follows him, disguised as a man, to Alcina's Bower of Bliss, where Morgana, Alcina's attendant, falls in love with her at first sight, thinking she's a man. In one of director Carson's most inspired scenes, Morgana sings a love song to Bradamante's jacket, which is hanging on a chair. Morgana kneels on the chair and wraps the empty sleeves of the jacket around her. She even slaps a sleeve when it tries to touch her improperly. The phenomenal French soprano Nathalie Dessay sings Morgana. Handel operas disappeared for more than a century and a half after their first successes. The 19th century, with its insistence on realism, couldn't handle Handel's plots about magic and sorcery. But the post-Freudian 20th century found in these implausible stories, as in mythology itself, profound patterns of all too human behavior. The winding corridors of Alcina's palace, like the woods in Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream, are like the interior of the human heart. Though Alcina's sacrifice of her power over others when she falls in love is darker and more painful than Shakespeare's comic transformations. At the beginning of the production, soprano Renee Fleming, as Alcina, rules every inch of her domain. When she loses her magic power, the elegant but blank white walls of Tobias Hoheisel's haunting set close slowly and relentlessly in on her, and in perfect time to the music. Handel's aching sympathy clearly went not to the virtuous lovers, but to the defeated sorceress. Thank you. The 19th century didn't know what to make of the music either. In Handel's long, formal, three-part arias, singers have to repeat the entire opening section. Audiences used to find this repetition merely repetitious. But as the young director Peter Sellers demonstrated in his memorable Handel productions, the repetitions can actually reveal the deepest insights. In the aria we just heard, for example, the repeated music underlines the increasing futility of Alcina's desperate incantations. Of course, no recording can capture the full range of a complete production. But early music conductor William Christie, his period orchestra, Les Arts Florissants, and the magnificent all-star cast perform this ravishing music as if it were actually about something powerful, urgent, and mysterious. And now you don't have to go to Paris or Chicago to hear that.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed a new recording of Handel's opera Alcina with Renee Fleming and Natalie Dessay on the Arado label. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, and Joan Tui Westman, with Anne-Marie Baldonado, Megan Howell, and Patty Leswing. Our researcher is Jessica Chu. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. And from HarperCollins Children's Books and Joanna Kotler Books, publishers of Penelope Jane, A Fairy Tale, a picture book and CD package by Roseanne Cash. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we remember John Lennon on the 20th anniversary of his assassination. We hear from Cynthia Lennon, Yoko Ono, and the author of a book about the FBI's secret files on Lennon. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air. Whatever gets you through the night.